For members only, Golf Smarter number 296, published on August 30, 2011.
SmarterPodcasts.com. Delivering sound advice.
Part two of the top 10 traits of better golfers with Jim Waldron.
This is Golf Smarter, sharing tips and insights from golfers and golf professionals to help lower your score. It's worked for your host, Fred Green.
Welcome back to Golf Smarter for members only, Jim.
Hi, Fred. How's it going?
It's going well, and it's interesting. Usually when we do a two-part conversation like this, we'll pick up the second part of the conversation immediately afterwards. We'll record for, you know, the first session, and then we'll just pick it up and continue the conversation. But we've actually had a couple days break to do this, and I've been thinking about those first two traits of being a better golfer: the mental focus, the sensory channel awareness, and was thinking a lot about the sensory channel awareness when I was on the golf course just yesterday. And
oh, cool.
I was thinking about it mostly on the green when I was putting. And
sure,
I was
yeah.
thinking about, okay, do I see his hand touching my shoulder? Do I feel his hand touching my shoulder? Am I aware of his hand touching? And I had a 15-foot putt for par that I sunk, and then I had a 24-foot putt for birdie that I made. Those are long putts for me. Yeah, and it was weird because I was like, okay, I see the hole. Do I know what it feels like to do it? I'm aware of the distance. Go for it. And it just kind of went exactly on the line that I wanted.
So that's exactly what we were talking about. That was your little strategy you figured out. Isn't that cool?
Cool? Are you kidding?
Yeah.
But then there were some problems as well. So I want to get to the top 10 traits, and then maybe throughout this conversation you'll find out what happened with this round and just the old adage of, you know, it all balances itself out. You know, you just you think you're on one of those great rounds, and all of a sudden it's like, oh, yeah, it's golf, and it'll be just what it always is.
Yeah.
But, okay, so we've got those. Now, we've got eight traits to go. I don't know if we'll be able to get to all eight the way
sure,
you and I
we'll
have
try.
Conversations, but let's...
Well, we should at least mention them, you know, before we finish, if we can't discuss them. But the third one is, of the ten, is probably, I would say, I've been thinking about this a lot. I think it is
Thank
the
you.
Most important of the ten. It's also the most difficult to explain in words, so you'll have to, you and your listenership will have to kind of bear with me here, but I've struggled coming up with the term, and the term I've been using for about, I don't know, 3 years now is awareness of awareness, which sounds kind of weird, I know, but...
Okay, you've spent way too much time in the Northern American wilderness. Awareness of awareness?
yeah. What that means is... you know, there's one aspect of your conscious mind is you can obviously focus it on a particular object, which we call the focal point, where your conscious mind is attending to, right? But there can be a very vague, sort of low-intensity threshold of awareness, which is not very effective for learning or for playing or for practice. Or there can be a very high-intensity awareness of detail and a super high level of clarity. It's the difference between sort of knowing something and really knowing something. So when you have 100% certainty about an issue, that would be an example of awareness of awareness. So, you know, I often use the analogy, if you find yourself somehow in a completely darkened house, and you stumbled around and you found a flashlight just by feeling around with your hands on the floor, and you found this object and you could tell it was a flashlight, and you flick on the switch, and you shine it over there in the corner, and there's a television. And then you shine it over, you know, a little place else, somewhere else in the room, and you see there's like a couch, right? So that's awareness. You know, okay, that's a TV, that's a couch. But then you stumble around a little further, and you find the wall switch, and you flick on the wall switch, and the whole room gets illuminated, and everything becomes clear as to what's in the room, right? The size of the room, the shape of the room, all the objects in it. That's what I would call awareness of awareness. So it's a very high level of awareness, of clarity.
Okay.
Remember the theme here is why do some people get golf quicker than others? I hate to use the word natural, but I guess for want of a better term, we can use it. Some people just have more talent for learning the game faster and more easier than other people. And those are good people, as I said at the beginning, to talk to. And that's a very common trait that those people have that I've worked with. They easily can become aware of what their body and club motion are doing during the swing, during the putting stroke, during a chip shot. And they can tell you. And here's an example. I worked with a real prodigy last summer, a young woman, a college player, who is the most talented player I've ever worked with, even more talented than Michelle Wee, who I spent 90 minutes with when she was 8 years old. Now, she blew me away, but this woman I worked with last year was even more talented than Michelle Wee, right? So,
oh, wait a minute, I got to stop you. I'm sorry, I've got to stop you. You opened the door on this one. You spent 90 minutes with Michelle Wee when she was 8 years old.
Correct,
As an instructor, you spent that time?
Yeah, I gave her a lesson. I did a clinic for the Oahu Junior Golf Association. There was 50 kids there up at Koala Golf Course in Oahu. And the night before, her dad called me and asked if I could work with her the next day in a private session. And I said, I think I have a prodigy in my hands. And of course, I said, yeah, I'll work with her.
Yeah, did you roll your eyes at that point? It's like, oh, another dad thinking they have a prodigy?
A little bit, because you hear that a lot.
Yeah, of course.
But she obviously was. I mean,
And then you saw her, and it was like, what was your reaction when you saw her?
Yeah, at that point in my teaching career, she was the best, you know, younger kid I'd ever seen by far.
Really?
Because she had about a 5-handicap male golf swing when she was 8 years old. Now, she wasn't hitting as far as a 5-handicap adult male, but, I mean, in terms of the mechanics, she had really good – I talked to her about target focus. One of the things that struck me as funny, because she already knew that, I mean, just intuitively, she was target-focused, not swing-focused. Oh. And I kept saying, are you sure you're focusing on the 100 yards? She was hitting an 8-iron to 100 yards. And she said, yeah. I go, are you thinking about your club hit? No, why would I do that?
Wow.
Thinking about your wrists? She looks at me, no, why would I want to think about my wrists? I'm thinking about where I want my ball to go. Which I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah.
But anyhow, this other gal, the one I'm talking about now, awesome. You know, a year ago, had the most awareness of awareness by far of anybody I've ever worked. I've worked with thousands of people in the last 20 years, right, and mm-hmm. including some pros. Tour pros. I asked her, like I do everybody, especially when I'm first working with them, I ask them for feedback. I want to know what's going on inside their mind during their actual golf swing, which is what really counts in golf. It's once your swing starts, that's the point where you can sabotage yourself and flinch, right? Which we all tend to do, being human and being golfers. And I wanted to see how aware she was of her body motion and of her club motion. So I asked her to give me some feedback on one particularly really good shot she hit with a 6-iron. And after 20 minutes, she was still talking. In other words, for 20 minutes, she's, well, in my left foot, I felt this. In my right foot, I felt this. In my left knee, I felt X. In my right knee, I felt Y. She started from the ground up and she scanned through her entire body and gave me a very detailed explanation of the forces, the energy forces in her body that she felt.
And how old was she?
22.
Oh, my God.
She went from a beginner golfer, relatively speaking, I mean, not total beginner, but basically someone who didn't play golf hardly at all, very, very, just a few times in her life. And within 20 months, she was a +1 handicap. Get this, no lessons, self-taught.
Wow.
Yeah, she's going to be.
She's one of those kids that's probably going to go to grad school. She's going to run to be a triathlete, right? One of those super achievers.
Yeah, yeah. Anyhow, so that's an example of what I mean awareness. Now, contrast with Joe Average. If I asked that question, you know what they would say? You know what Joe Average would say if I said, "What did you notice in that last swing?"
Joe Average. Joe Average. You mean the golf smarter listener?
Joe Average golfer. He'd say, "I don't know. Yeah. Well, just a blur to me."
Yeah,
I go, no, focus your mind. What did you notice in that last swing? I don't know. Felt okay. You know, it's true. I mean, I'm not exaggerating. That's the normal reaction. People don't know what just happened inside their swing, and good players do, and they can tell you.
Yeah, it sounded good.
Yeah. So you can develop that through going back to the first two, mental focus, learning how to focus your mind like a laser beam. If you're talking about swing motion, on one body part or one aspect of the club motion, maybe the club face angle position throughout the swing, or the club head, the feeling of the club head weight throughout the swing, or the club head path throughout the swing, or the shaft plane angle throughout the swing, or what you feel in your right shoulder, or with what point in the downswing you feel your wrist cock angle begin to open up, which is one of the really, really big important ones from a timing standpoint. And also the feel part, which is the second one we talked about, you know, being in the feel channel as opposed to being stuck in visual or stuck in auditory. Because, you know, again, the only way you can get objective remotely, a remote chance of even having objective feedback is in feel. Because the other two channels are symbolic. You know, they're picturing your swing or talking about your swing as opposed to feeling your swing, right? So that's awareness of awareness, pretty important from a learning and a training standpoint especially. It's extremely important to have that, right?
Okay, then because we're going to need to, you know, move fairly quick here. So let's go to the next one.
So the fourth element of these 10, we talked about the better players have, is what I like to call a strong mind-body connection. And that's kind of almost the opposite of the feedback system, which was number two from feel. This is a feed-forward system where the good player, the better golfer can sort of ask their body to do something it hasn't done before, a new movement, a new motor pattern, and the body gets the message and carries out the new movement pattern.
That's really difficult, actually.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
My younger son, I don't know if we've talked about this enough, but my younger son is just starting to play, and he's not asking me for advice, nor will I give it to him. But then he said, you know, I just want to get better. And I said, well, you know, you're going to have to really start with your position, your grip, and alignment. I mean, you've never had a lesson. You really don't know what you're doing. And I'm looking at you, and I can tell that those things are wrong, that you're not, you know, your grip is completely wrong, and you're wondering why, you know, you're doing all these things. Yeah. And he says, well, I how am I going to change those things? That's how I do it. And I said, well, you know, I said, you know, I just had a guy show me something, and now I've incorporated that into my swing. So I'm able to focus on being able to do that, and I can change it. He goes, well, how can I change it? This is how my swing is. I said, no, I think if you really want to do it, you can.
Yeah, well, what he was giving you was resistance. That's like a resistant client in psychotherapy.
No, that's like my son.
Well, a lot of kids are like, especially if it's the parent giving him the advice, right?
Right, and I know he doesn't listen to this, so I can say that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting because before we started talking this morning, I was watching the Golf Channel, and it was a recap of yesterday's round, of the first round of the PGA when Tiger shot 77, and they showed his press conference afterward where he was almost on the verge of tears. Imagine,
really?
Tiger Woods.
Wow.
And he basically said, my old motor patterns kept coming up. I started out in the first, I was 3 under in the first 5 holes. I was focusing hard on my new movement patterns, right? And I was able to, because I was focusing hard on the new movement patterns, they were manifesting in my swing motion, which means my mind-body connection was strong, right?
Mm-hmm.
He goes, then I figured, okay, I have it. I'll just trust it and let it happen. So he went to the next level, which he wasn't ready to get to yet, and his whole game fell apart, and he shot 10 over in the next 15 or 13 holes. He was 10 over with 2 doubles. So he hadn't gotten yet to that point where he could totally trust it. He still needed to have some focus on the new movement pattern, some intentionality of his, you know, sort of his psychic energy devoted to focusing on sort of switching on those neuromuscular pathways, the new motor patterns, right? You know, and that's something, some of this is certainly innate. Some people are born with more athletic ability, a stronger mind-body connection than others, which doesn't mean people who have a poor mind-body connection can't get better at it. They certainly can through practice, right? But it is something that the people who get golf quickly and easily have. They have the ability to quickly get their body to do the new movement pattern that their teacher is trying to get them to do.
Well, that's what I didn't want to talk about. What I mentioned earlier about my round the other day is after the first 6 holes, for the first time in my golf career, I was even.
No kidding.
Yeah, I parred.
Fantastic.
It was amazing. I parred the first 4. I bogeyed number 5, par 3, and number 6, I was the birdie putt.
Right.
And so I was even. And I'm like, okay, I'm not going to get excited about this. I'm just going to try to stay focused. I'm not going to even talk about it. You know, this is good. I've never done this, and I know what's going on, but I'm just going to try to focus on my next swing. And over the next 3 holes, I was 9 over.
No kidding.
In 3 holes. And by the 10th hole, 11th hole, I'm like, I don't even know how to swing a golf club right now. I am so lost and so uncomfortable. And it wasn't until the last 5 holes when I went 3 over that I was like, oh, shoot, that's what's going on. I kind of had a sense of what I realized what I was doing, and got back into a better groove, feeling better about it. But it was it turned so quickly on me.
Well, it's interesting. What you just mentioned, you noticed what you were doing wrong, and you got back on track. That's the awareness of the awareness thing we talked about.
Oh, good.
Yeah, so that's
I'm learning.
That's how you can right the ship, so to speak, right?
Yeah. Well, it seems so.
Yeah, in fact, another aspect of awareness is knowing. We talked about knowing your strategies. Do I visualize the target, then feel my grip pressure, then tell myself I'm a great ball striker, then go back to visualizing the target, and when I do that four-step strategy, are those my best shots, right? And then having enough awareness about that issue to remember it when you go to the golf course, right?
Yeah. I think what ended up happening was I realized I only had two balls left in my bag, so I really better get back on track.
That's good. Yeah. Anyhow, so some of this is also called visual spatial awareness. It's one of the technical terms as part of this mind body connection thing. And you know, back to modeling. You know, you can model. Kids tend to do this. If most kids who played, most good golfers who started as kids, had an adult in their life that they could, like their head pro or an instructor or a low handicap amateur who was sort of a golf mentor, and they simply watched that person hit a lot of balls, and they kind of absorbed their overall swing motion directly into their subconscious through what's called visual spatial awareness. So they can watch a good player and sort of mimic what they see that person do, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's a really important skill to develop. And I've had people who are just the opposite, who are extremely poor at this. I've had several students, even doing slow motion mirror work in front of a mirror, I'll be behind their mirror, posing in the halfway down position in the downswing where the club shaft's parallel to the ground and the wrists are still fully cocked, right? Mm-hmm. Hands are about waist high, a little below waist high. And I'll ask them to mimic my position, and they won't even come close to mimicking. I mean, unbelievable difference. I mean, where the club shaft's almost touching, where the club head's almost touching the ground, not parallel to the ground.
Right.
And the wrists are fully released, and their hips are not open. They're basically square. My hips are wide open. And I'll say, are you in the position I'm in? And they'll look at me, and they'll look at themselves in the mirror, and they'll go, uh-huh.
Wow.
And that's someone has really poor, and I'm not exaggerating, this happens all the time.
I bet.
That's very poor visual spatial awareness, that they can't tell the difference between a club shaft that's perpendicular to the ground, their club shaft, and mine that's parallel, right? So that person needs a lot of work on how to strengthen their mind-body connection. There's three things you can do that are not golf that can really help. One is Tai Chi, probably the best of the three. If you take Tai Chi classes, just trust me, folks, that'll strengthen your mind-body connection more than anything. The second thing is Pilates classes or even private sessions in Pilates, really, really excellent for strengthening the mind-body connection. The third is yoga. If you did a yoga class, a Tai Chi class, and a Pilates class once a week each, in a month, you probably have a 500% stronger mind-body connection.
Well, two out of three ain't bad for me. We actually had a Lynn Marriott. I don't know if...
Oh, yeah, I know Lynn, sure.
Oh, Lynn's amazing. And she talked about a Tai Chi swing in practice, just doing the swing as slowly as you possibly can.
That's right.
We talked about this a couple of years ago, and it always resonated with me because I can never do it. And that when you do the swing that slowly, it magnifies where your mistakes are.
Correct.
The
slow motion thing is huge. That's the hallmark. That's the cornerstone of the balance point training method is slow motion.
Uh-huh.
I adapted it when I was a kid because I started studying Asian martial arts at a very young age, and I was also a struggling junior golfer, and I started doing slow motion mirror work in 1961. And then I found out that Hogan discovered it back in the late 1930s, and that's how he made all his major swing changes. So I've been... Yeah, we actually have what we call a super slow motion swing, which takes 1 minute, 60 seconds from start to finish.
Painful. Yeah. Couldn't do it.
Yeah.
Could not do it. And Jamie Zimron is someone who comes on Golf Smarter frequently, and she calls herself the golf sensei.
Uh-huh.
I mean, she incorporates a lot of Aikido and things like that.
Mm. All right, you ready for number five?
I'm ready for number five. I'm taking notes.
Five is, again, the better golfers, the people who get it easily, relatively easily, have the ability to coordinate body parts that are moving in opposite spatial dimensions simultaneously, just like rubbing your tummy and patting your head.
Coordinate opposite body parts. Is that what you said?
Yep, they're moving in opposite dimensions. We're in a three-dimensional spatial dimensional universe where we got length, we got the vertical dimension up and down. We got the side-to-side dimension, or they're toward the target or away from the target dimension. That's also called the horizontal dimension in golf. And we got the width dimension, so length, width, and height, right? And, you know, certain body parts are moving more or less completely or mostly in the vertical dimension, like your wrists are cocking up and down, right, in a vertical dimension, right? Mm-hmm. Your arms are basically moving mostly up and down the vertical dimension, and your body pivot is moving in the horizontal dimension. And so we have to learn to coordinate body parts that are literally moving in opposite directions simultaneously. And that's, it's just like rubbing your tummy and patting your head, but much more difficult even than that.
Yeah.
And some people just struggle with that because their brain is, I call it having a one-dimensional brain. Most people's brains want all the body parts to move in the same plane, the same dimension. And that's why they're 40 handicappers.
Yeah, and I think it's also difficult for a lot of golfers, the higher handicap and newer golfers, to comprehend, and it took me a long time, that there are different swings. That you're not going to swing from 20 yards in with a lob wedge the same way you're going to swing
exactly.
a three wood.
Very much.
You have
correct.
To know yeah. that it's not just one type of swing. And it's,
that's correct.
Oof,
yeah.
That's hard.
Yeah, that's... In fact, the timing, especially when you get into short game shots, there's probably 300 different short game swings.
Oh, I didn't need to know.
And some of those have major differences in timing amongst themselves. Like, one of the hardest shots is like a lob wedge from like, 15 to 20 yards where your hands get back to waist high, but you have a full wrist cock. So you get maximum height on the shot because of the full wrist cock.
And
you got to cock your wrist fully in half the time you normally cock it, and you have to release it fully in less than half the time you normally release it. So a totally different timing pattern, right?
Plus the fact that there's a bunker between you and the flag is close to the edge, and it's just at the base of a knoll.
Yeah, all of which makes it hard, right?
So really hard.
We do that, yeah, in our training program, we have our students do that shot a lot because all the things we're talking about here about awareness, you have to have to the max on that shot to pull it off. It's a very, very difficult shot to pull off. So it's a great training exercise for that
reason.
Yeah,
and let's not discount the fact that sometimes you're doing it from a deep rough and sometimes you're doing it from a hard pan. Two completely different shots.
Yeah, and that actually changes how you do it. I mean, you'd open the face in the rough and keep the face more or less square off a hard pan so you don't have too much bounce coming in, right? So.
Yep.
Yeah.
Can't do that.
And, so that's a big one. And, again, back to the same thing we talked about earlier, the Pilates, the Tai Chi, the yoga will help with the coordination part, right?
And the Pilates and yoga is really helping with my back.
Oh, yeah, if you get back issues, especially the Pilates, is fantastic for people with back problems, yeah.
Yep.
Okay, number six.
Number
confidence.
Six.
Confidence. Now, this is a big issue, and I always use the two of my favorite coaches in terms of the kind of results they produce in basketball, although they're polar opposites, are Bobby Knight and John Wooden, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm much more of a John Wooden fan than a Bobby Knight fan, but there's a funny story about this, which is that Bobby Knight had a sign in his locker room, and I won't use the actual term because it's a little bit of an obscenity, but
if it's Bobby Knight, of course it's an obscenity. If you want to, I can bleep it out.
I can use a shorthand version, which I think is acceptable.
Okay.
Confidence is BS, right?
Wow.
But Wooden was all about confidence. He had his pyramid of success, all the different traits, kind of like what we're talking about here. He had these, except there were more than 10, but his basketball training program, there was a whole series of fundamentals starting at the base of the pyramid. Some of these were mechanical, some were physical fitness issues. A lot of it was mental, leading to a peak. And I forget where exactly in there, but confidence was a big part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, this is one of those lovely philosophical chicken versus egg arguments, which comes first, right? And my whole thing is avoid the fallacy of the extremes, the logical fallacy. The human brain is sort of hardwired to think it's either black or it's white. When in reality, most things in life, it's a blend of both,
That's great.
So we can avoid that fallacy.
Yeah.
And the reality is, you can get much more confidence when you work on your mechanics, when you work on your physical fundamentals, because when you master more physical fundamentals, your ball flight will improve dramatically, and that will give you confidence, right? On the other hand, you can practice confidence, and I teach my students to do this, as a standalone fundamental of the golf swing, of the putting stroke, of the putting game, and of the short game. In other words, you can teach people who are not confident for whatever reason, poor mechanics or just poor, just poor mental game, and you can say, here's how you can access a confident frame of mind. Go practice that exercise. Right? And then when you're confident, guess what? Your mechanics get better. Right?
Yeah.
Your swing gets better.
I know that that confidence really comes from success, doesn't it?
Well, that's what I'm saying. See, Bobby Knight would say confidence only comes after you have physical skill.
Uh-huh.
Bob Rotella would say confidence is something you can learn to access regardless of whatever level of mechanical skill you have.
Wow.
And I say both things are true,
mm-hmm.
right? Why not practice your way to confidence by becoming better physically at your technique, but also why not practice confidence as a standalone fundamental? Which is the fastest way to do it. I mean, the quickest way to get to confidence is not to work on confidence as the end product of months or years of training, but to say, you know what, when I'm in that confident frame of mind, which people sort of randomly fall into this, golfers do, who knows why, just some days you feel more confident than others, right? I guarantee you, anybody listening to this podcast knows this is true. On those days, for whatever reason, you feel more confident, you play your best golf.
Yep.
Right? Mm-hmm. With the same bad swing you had the day before, you play better golf. Your swing is better physically. I'm not saying it's going to be like dramatically better mechanically, but your ability to compensate for your swing flaws is better on those days when you have confidence. Your balance is better. Your rhythm is better. Your tempo is better on those days when you're confident.
And like I was just talking about my round the other day, it can disappear in a heartbeat. I mean, when I nailed that 24-foot putt, I saw the line and said, I got it. I know what this is. I can see it going in the hole. No problem. And within two holes, I'm like, I have no idea what I'm doing out here.
Yeah, but here's the thing about these better players I'm talking about. Again, the really, you know, exceptional golfers. If they have a bad hole or two or three or four in a row, they don't lose their confidence.
Right.
At least not very much. They still believe in themselves. I can do this. And the poor golfer, one bad swing, forget even a bad hole, their confidence is gone for the whole round.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Right? And they start questioning everything, and they start announcing.
Oh, exactly.
Talk about that.
How do I fix it? They go into what I call panic mode. How do I fix it? How do I fix it?
What I do? Yeah.
Well, you fix it by going back into your state of confidence. That's how you fix it. You don't fix it by trying to give yourself a swing lesson, or as Hogan said, the downswing is no time to give yourself a swing lesson. It lasts a quarter of a second. So, anyhow, confidence. So seven. Is there's three more or less physical skills or physical fundamentals that these exceptional golfers sort of have naturally, right? Without even any instruction, or at least very little instruction. One is consistently smooth tempo. The other is fluid rhythm, and the third is balance. They can swing in balance from start to finish, and they can finish their swing in rock solid balance. And they just seem to have that sort of natural ability to do all three of those things.
Tell me the three again. I'm sorry, because I'm writing.
Consistent and smooth tempo, meaning they don't have a jerk in their the flow of their body, how their body parts move. There's a smooth acceleration of their body, and there's a relationship in time between their backswing and their forward swing. It doesn't look jerky. It looks smooth, and it's pretty much the same tempo on all their full shots from swing to swing. They don't vary it a lot.
Yeah, I think of Ernie Els when you say things like that. I mean, to me, that swing is just so clean.
Yeah.
And he gets so much power out of it.
And, you know, some of this, again, is natural, but, again, you can obviously learn these things. But they have that sort of innate sense of the timing of the swing. How long should it take, right? Which basically means avoid extremes, not too quick and not too slow. And, by the way, for everybody listening, most of our students, 99% of our golfers, when they have bad tempo, they're too slow. They're not too fast. That's a huge myth in golf. Most people are way, way too slow.
Really?
I mean, at least 50% slower than a tour pro, at least. Now, I'm not talking about, 90-year-old guys who, because they're riddled with arthritis and they're stiff, they're going to be slow, of course. I'm talking about someone who's reasonably, flexible.
When I was screwing things up, I kind of slow down. I'm rushing everything here. I'm swinging too hard, swinging too fast. Slow down.
That's because you're too armsy. See, but people confuse the mechanical flaw called being armsy, having the arms dominate the motion in a disconnected way, disconnected from the body. Yeah, if your arms are flailing like they normally do in the wrong dimension and, separating from your body, and they're doing that bad mechanical move faster, that's a mechanical flaw. That's not a tempo flaw. Tempo is how long it takes your pivot from the moment you begin to turn your body till you stop turning your body at the finish. That's tempo. And what typically happens when people's arms get quicker in the wrong dimension, meaning in the horizontal dimension, sideways instead of up and down like they should be moving, they also slow down their pivot. So the more armsy you are, the slower your pivot is, which means your tempo is slowing down. It feels to the golfer like they're speeding up. Some of that's adrenaline, stress, cortisol, you know, just that panic mode we talked about, which makes time seem to go quicker. But basically, their actual tempo, the elapsed time they're swinging from start to finish, is actually slowing down when their swing goes south. So that's key. Rhythm is the relationship in time between your backswing and your downswing until the moment of impact, and that should be about a 2-to-1 ratio in time. So your backswing, if you have medium tempo, should take about 3/4 of a second, roughly. And your downswing should take about half that much time, 3/8 of a second, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there's a 2-to-1. So that's a bump, bump, bump. That's the basic rhythm of golf and a lot of things, too. It's the basic rhythm in music, too. Bump, bump, bump.
Yeah.
Bump, bump, bump. One, two, three.
Yep. We have in our golfer's mart a thing called tour tempo that does that rhythm in your head. And I've used it a lot, and that rhythm is in my head a lot. We still have them if anybody wants to pick one of those up, the tour tempo. And we're going to get... We're going to get him back on the show, too, but I found that
I guess he's changed
really
it. I saw a post by John Novosel, the guy who created Tour Tempo.
Right, he's been on.
My disagreement with his original research, I believe he's changed it, was he defined the start of the forward swing, which is common sense, is when you see, in looking at slow-mo video, 30 frames a second, is when you see the club head start to change direction. But in reality, that's not when the forward swing begins in a good golf swing. A good golf swing, the forward swing begins while the shoulders are still continuing the backswing. So if you look at a golfer's particularly from the rear view, if you have the camera behind the golfer, looking at their butt, when the tailbone starts to shift, actually even before that, because there's an invisible thing happening you can't see on video, which is the stomach muscles, the core shifts to the left even before you see the tailbone shift laterally to the left. That's the moment when the downswing begins. And that happens for most tour pros when they're roughly in their 3/4 backswing position. So, you know, if they swing normally to where their left arm is in the 10:30 o'clock position, if that's their normal top of backswing position, they start their downswing when their left arm is around 9:30 or so, 9:45, maybe 10 at the latest. That's when the forward swing really begins. So that's how we measure the rhythm. So from that point, it's actually a 2-to-1. Whereas if you use Novosel's original research, it was 3-to-1, measuring from a little bit later in time when the club starts to change directions.
Well, then I'm going to have to get him back on the show. I want to talk to him again. He's really good.
See, and then the third is balance. I mean, people who struggle with golf, unbeknownst to them, have poor balance. I remember I had a gentleman take the school about 5 years ago, and the first thing we do in our 3-day great shot swing school, which is like a 3-day, 8-hour-a-day boot camp on the golf swing fundamentals, we do two things. We check the very first thing at 9 o'clock on Friday morning. We watch everybody hit balls for about 10 minutes, and we check their baseline balance and their baseline tempo. If they're too slow with their tempo, or too fast with their tempo, or if they're off balance, badly off balance, not a little off balance, we tell them, look, you're below baseline on balance, or you're below baseline tempo. You're wasting your time working in mechanics until you fix those things first. Right? Now, we had a guy who every single swing, his balance was so bad, his feet, both his feet would move about probably a foot to 18 inches from where they started, right? Not even close to being in the same body position.
Wow.
And he actually thought he had good balance. He had his mind was so fixated on what the ball flight was going to be, right? Like most golfers are, they pay too much attention to the ball flight. They don't pay enough attention to what they're doing, which creates the ball flight, good or bad. That he had no clue that he was moving his position that badly. You know, he just had no idea.
From the time he starts his backswing till the time he finishes the swing complete, his feet were in different places?
I mean, when he finished up, right?
Yeah.
He was leaning the wrong way. Instead of tilting a little bit toward the ground like when he started, having some spine angle, he was tilted the other way, way up the other way.
Uh-huh.
And his feet had completely moved by about a foot. He was stepping out of his position as he approached the finish. But he had no idea. I mean, this is what he'd been playing golf at this point for about 30 years. This is how he always did it. It was unconscious. He didn't pay any attention to it.
Was this one of those guys that mimicked Palmer, that he did that little, that swing where he's moving forward and almost taking the step forward after his swing?
Well, that was Gary. That was, you're thinking of Player with a step-through move.
Yeah.
Player did that more as a exaggeration drill for, I guess he must have found himself hanging back and not shifting his weight enough, you know, to the forward swing.
Okay.
But yeah, it was sort of like that, but with both feet, not just his back foot, both feet were moving. I mean, but not even close to being a proper finish. I mean, just terrible balance. So, you know, that's not that unusual. And whereas, again, the exceptional golfer finishes pretty much in rock-solid balance, probably 90% of the time or more.
Wow.
So, again, it can be learned. Doesn't have to be innate. You can learn to do this. It doesn't take very much time either.
Great. We're up to
number eight.
Yep.
The three P's. This is right out of the Bob Rotella playbook. I'm a big fan of Bob's work, and this is what he talks about all the time. Patience, perseverance, persistence. And Rotella's thing is if you have those three qualities, that's far more important than whatever innate talent for golf you might have. In other words, you can work your way to better golf if you have patience, perseverance, and persistence, which is the long-term, you know, long-term view of improvement. Daniel Goldman, I think he's a social psychologist from Harvard, wrote a book about 10 years ago. It was on the New York Times bestseller list for like 3 months, called Emotional Intelligence. And him and his team studied successful people in all kinds of ways, financially successful, successful parents, successful in their career, people who were, you know, very healthy, musicians, athletes, you know, people like that, scholars. And they came up with 100 traits of people who were good, who achieved high rates of success in their life. And the number one predictor of success was the ability to postpone instant gratification. The number one predictor, by far, more than the other 99 almost combined. It was that big a predictor of success.
Interesting.
Yeah, so that's the long-term view. Now, not too many golfers have that, but again, these exceptional golfers do. They get to be good golfers because they work their way. I'll give you an example. I played golf a few weeks ago with a guy who was a typical average golfer, stuck around like a 20 handicap for the first 10 years or so playing golf. He's in his mid-50s now, been playing for like 30 years, 35 years. Got tired of being a 15 to 20, go up and down between a 15 and 20 handicap. Took some instruction, got fitted with some good clubs. Start studying the game a little bit, reading a little bit about the mental side, reading a little bit about the swing. And over a period of about 10 years, got himself down to a plus one, which is really good.
Really good.
Yeah. And I asked him how. He goes, I worked my way to it. I worked my way to a plus one. And people think there's some, like, magic way out there. You know, that's sort of the golf sort of media marketplace. There's a magic training aid or a magic swing key or a magic this or a magic that. It's all BS.
No, it's true. That's how this industry is going to continue to survive, and guys like you are going to continue to work because there is a magic potion.
Yeah, not a balance point there isn't. We're like the opposite of that. Go on our website, check it out. Pretty much every paragraph of every page, it says there are no magic moves. You got to work your way. You got to find out what the rock solid fundamentals are. A lot of which are counterintuitive, are not natural, don't feel comfortable, and through patience, perseverance, persistence, self discipline, the long term view, the work ethic, you can get really good at this game. Right. So that's eight. How are we doing on time?
No, I want instant gratification. Oh, we're way over time. Number nine.
Okay, number nine. Number nine and ten are closely related. There are two, and I've talked about this on your show before, there are two very, very natural destructive impulses that everybody in golf deals with, including Tiger Woods. In fact, Tiger finally appears to have overcome his biggest flaw, which is the hit impulse, which is actually technically number ten, but... The number nine is the manipulation impulse. So when you have the impulse to make the ball go straight, what will happen is a lot of bad things will happen mechanically. Typically, your grip pressure will tighten up, and you'll try to steer the club head into the ball in a straight line motion. Mm-hmm. You'll try to force the club head to stay square on a long game shot, which it should not do. The club face should go slightly from square to shut during release, right? Mm-hmm. A little bit, not a lot. That's a requirement, even to hit a straight ball, not even to hit a draw or a hook. I mean, just if the ball's straight, the club face must go from square to slightly closed from the halfway down position to impact. It has to close around 10 to 15 degrees for the ball to go straight, right? And when you don't let that, and that happens because your forearms are rotating a little bit for a right-handed golfer counterclockwise. If you don't let that natural forearm rotation happen because your forearm muscles are tight with muscle tension, right, or your grip pressure is tight or both, you'll actually hit a push slice off to the right. So when you try to steer the ball straight, you typically hit a slice, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's called the manipulation impulse. And again, these exceptional golfers find a way to struggle through that, to overcome that manipulation impulse, and they do it fairly quickly. Whereas the poor golfer really struggles with that issue, right? That's a big issue. 10 is the hit impulse. That has to do with the misunderstanding of power. So when you release your wrist cock angle too early, which is any time you start to release your wrist cock angle in the downswing, when your hands are anywhere between waist high or above waist high, and the earlier you release it, the higher your handicap. You could actually chart a handicap level. 40 handicaps release it from as soon as they start their downswing. Immediately. From the top of the backswing, they throw the wrist cock angle away. 30 handicaps do it about 5 inches lower. 25 handicaps do it 2 inches lower than that. You can just keep going down. And when you get to a zero handicap, they release it when their hands are about the level of their hips.
Wow.
Right?
That's so interesting.
Yeah, and that's not the only way. You can also lunge your body, which is a body lunge is a form of a hit impulse. You can pull your arms across your chest from the top of the swing. That's an armsy way of doing the hit impulse. You can throw the angle in your right arm angle away. That's the right arm angle way. And really high handicaps tend to do all four of those ways, so more or less simultaneously. So, you know, that's a big issue. And, it's natural. Every golfer who's ever played golf has suffered from both of those impulses. But the exceptional golfer finds a way to overcome that hit impulse. And just for people listening, what's the easy answer? Again, there is no easy answer, right? But if there was one, there is a way you can train yourself to overcome the wrist throw part, not so much the body lunge and the arm part. But anytime you throw your wrist cock angle away from your wrist muscles, your finger pressure tightens for a microsecond earlier. So if you can keep your grip pressure light and constant during transition into your downswing, it's physically impossible to throw your wrist cock angle away early. Can't happen. You'll always squeeze your fingers first, then your wrist muscles will tighten and throw.
Yeah, but if there was a simple answer, an easy way to do it, we'd stop playing golf.
Yeah, that's true.
I think that part of the attraction, and again, part of a conversation I was having with my kid the other day about golf is like, you know, that round that my older one took me out for, you know, to play. And that round, I was saying, because I played so well in the beginning and in the end, that middle part makes me want to go, I can succeed. I can do this. So that, to me, was the anomaly. I want to go out and do it again.
Yeah.
If it was so
cool?
Easy. Yeah. If it was so easy, if I was excellent at it from the beginning, okay, so now what else can I do?
That's why we play golf, and we've talked
exactly.
about this before in other shows. I mean, it's people forget that Scottish Calvinists invented this game. If you know about Scottish Calvinism, right, the whole idea is, in Calvinism, the more you suffer on the earthly plane, the more you're guaranteed entry into heaven. So people who embrace suffering on earth are the people who invented this game. So that's why they made the rules so penal, you know. So you got to remember that. That's the background. That's the historical background of golf, right?
And, if you've never seen Robin Williams' routine about golf,
you have to watch.
Go to YouTube.
He talks about that in that routine. That's right. He just brings up
absolutely.
That exact point.
And he says, so all you have to do, go to Google, because I can't put it on my website, go to Google and type in Robin Williams golf and sit yourself down and prepare to laugh very hard for at least 10 minutes.
Yeah, yeah, that's a good point. Oh, and there's one more. There's an 11th one. I forgot.
Oh, a bonus round.
I kept a bonus one. And this is probably, I would say, I used to say this was number one. Now I say it's tied with awareness of awareness. And I've said this on your show before. But here's the thing, guys. If you really want to get good at this game, the more you can detach your ego, your sense of self-worth or self-esteem, from the outcome of the shot, from the score in that particular hole you're playing, from your score for that day when you walk off the 18th green, for whatever your current handicap level is or average score, the more you can keep those issues separate from your emotional side of your nature, the more effective your learning is going to be when you take lessons, the more effective your practice sessions are going to be, and the lower your scores are going to be. How ironic is that? When you let go of emotional attachment to score improvement, you instantly improve your score. And that's what I call detachment/perspective, one of 12 core states of excellence in our program.
I am now and hopefully we'll get them up on the Golfer's Mart. I'm going to have bumper stickers made that says "Detach Ego from Outcome."
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. Because we get in our
GolfSmarter.com.
Yeah, we sabotage ourselves. We sabotage everything about learning, training, and performance when we feel bad about ourselves when we hit a bad shot. That's the neurosis I'm talking about. You have to. This is one of my 18 gates too, right? You have to get over that. You can't. I always tell my students when they hit it, because we do these all-day golf schools where, of course, people are going to hit some bad shots. I mean, I'll just be honest. People hit bad shots. They hit bad shots before they come to the school. They hit bad shots during the school, and they hit bad shots after they graduate. They also hit really, really good shots during the school, and they continue to hit really good shots some of the time after they graduate. But the point is, when they hit a bad shot, the average person in our school, you can tell by their body language, they feel bad, like they're bad. So my saying is, hey, when you hit a bad shot, doesn't mean you're a bad person. And conversely, when you hit a good shot, doesn't mean you're a good person. They're two separate things entirely, right? You got to keep your self-esteem separate from what happens in golf in terms of outcomes. Otherwise, the game is so brutal, it'll just beat you up. It's too hard.
Yep, absolutely. Oh, Jim, tell us the website. Get us motivated.
www.balancepointgolf.com.
All one word, balancepointgolf.com. And, you don't really need to say the www anymore.
That's true. I forget that.
Yeah, balancepointgolf.com.
Right.
Detach ego from outcome, golfsmarter.com. That's the bumper sticker. If you want one, send me an email. We'll get these made up. Detach ego from outcome.
Yeah.
And the golf schools, because I have to believe that, even myself, after listening to these two conversations, for almost an hour and a half worth of conversation, that's the kind of stuff you go, I want to work with this guy. I want this guy to be teaching me to improve my game. So tell me some about the school real quickly.
Well, this is our 17th year. We started over in Hawaii in the winter of 95. Our summer base is Portland. From May through October, we're in Portland. We do occasionally we'll do a schools down in the desert in Palm Springs in the spring and fall. We're going to be opening up schools next year in Asia. I'm not sure exactly where yet. Probably China, but not 100% sure on that. I'm going over there for 2 months this winter to kind of set it up.
Nice.
We were a 2-time Golf Magazine Top 25 Golf School in the Nation Award winner. This is all on our website. We have a very unique approach. It's
obviously
absolutely original. I can guarantee it's not nobody else in golf is doing what we're doing.
Dude, that's why I keep bringing you back on the show.
I spend 90% of my time teaching people the mechanics of the game because that's what people want to learn, and that's obviously really important. But we do it in a way that incorporates three other aspects: the mental focus aspect, the emotional side, which is what we just talked about, keeping the self-esteem separate, and the physical fitness side, right? So those three things are really important. Mm-hmm. To learn how to do the mechanics, you have to have a focused mind, especially of those three. The mind part is the most important. To learn effectively, you have to have a focused mind. So
yeah.
But it's a technical approach. There's a lot of technical information about plane angles and where your body parts have to be at certain points in the swing. But the difference is you don't think about that over a golf shot. We do all of that type of training only in slow motion in front of a mirror. There's no mechanical thoughts done whatsoever or used whatsoever when we hit a golf ball. Hmm. There are rhythm thoughts. That's not mechanical. There are balance thoughts. That's not mechanical, right? Hmm.
So, if you go down in Southern California, if you go start teaching down in Palm Desert or something, let me know, and I'll hook you up with Tony Manzoni.
Yeah, we'll do it. Yeah, that'll be fun.
Yeah,
the college in the desert, yeah.
Yeah, I think you guys would have a really interesting – actually, I want to be there to record that conversation because it could go on for quite a while.
I'm sure it would, yeah.
I'm sure it would. Oh, Jim, so great to talk to you again. Thanks so much for giving me so much of your time so we can do a couple episodes here. And, of course, you will be coming back for more.
All right, thanks, Fred. Great to be here.
Each week, I'll start my Tuesday by publishing a Golf Smarter episode. But this morning, I teed off on the back nine at San Geronimo just before sunrise. As expected, the Bay Area's summer morning fog hung over the fairway just high enough to follow our ball off the tee. I'd forgotten how much I love playing early morning golf. The horses that reside just behind the 13th tee were bucking and playing with each other like I'd never seen before. The hawks and crows were abusing one another. The ball couldn't roll very far as the dew-covered rough reached out for its morning hug. Then I was in my office by 9. How can you have a bad day when it starts like that? Up next, author David Wood joins us to share stories from his book, Around the World in 80 Rounds. Questions, comments, suggestions? Just click on the Hey Fred button at golfsmarter.com.
Smarterpodcasts.com. Delivering sound advice.